Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A seed smuggler penned our Declaration of Independence. Our nation's first president was obsessed by the perfect pink of crabapple for his revolutionary garden. And the Revolutionary War was led by the inspiration of the Liberty Tree. Little did we know that our founding fathers mixed politics and botany, each elemental to the sowing of our early democracy. This hour On Point, the green thumbs of our founding fathers. You can join the conversation as you begin your own planting this season. Can you envision our founding fathers at work in their own gardens? Have you been inspired by a visit to Jefferson's Monticello or Madison's Montpelier? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in Richmond, Virginia, is Andrea Wolfe, garden historian and author of Founding Gardeners, The Revolutionary Generation, Nature, and the Shaping of the American Nation. Welcome to you. Nice to have you, Andrea.
Hi, Jane.
You say it's impossible to understand the making of America without looking at the Founding Fathers as farmers and gardeners. How did Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison view agriculture and gardening?
Well, they very much saw agriculture as the foundation of the young republic, and they all used nature and gardening in different ways in their fight for America. And I think what is really important to remember is that they would have all said that they regarded themselves foremost as farmers and as gardeners and not as politicians. So they were more likely to talk about the merits of plows, for example, than politics.
In fact, that gardening was the noblest of occupations.
Yes. They very often used, for example, metaphors drawn from the natural world to explain politics. And one of them was the nurturing of a tree when they compared the creation of a nation. So they very much saw this as a project that had to be nurtured like you would nurture a garden.
So set the scene for us and help us understand how the Founding Fathers understood the importance of plants and agriculture in terms of how it all provided economic independence from Britain, but also the symbolic meanings behind agriculture and plants and gardening as well.
Well, I think it works on very many levels. I mean, the most obvious is the one you mentioned first, which is the economic independence. So only if a country was self-sufficient could it be independent from Britain. So agricultural crops became incredibly important. And the first one to really understand that was actually Benjamin Franklin, who is, while he's in London and in the run-up to the Declaration of Independence, he's starting to send more and more seeds to America. So the more he believes independence is inevitable, the more seeds he's sending over to America. But it also works on a kind of ideological level, I would say, which is the Jeffersonian vision of America as an agrarian republic. And it works in terms of national identity because America's landscape and towering trees become imbued with patriotism and become a reflection of a strong nation. And it works literally and symbolically in their gardens when they start to use native species really as a patriotic statement. Mm.
In fact, Thomas Jefferson, you write in the book, encouraged Americans to that point to plant sugar maple orchards in order to stop buying molasses, right, from the British West Indies.
Yes, there's this wonderful journey which Madison and Jefferson actually take in the summer of 1791. This is at the time when Alexander Hamilton is its Secretary of Treasury, and Hamilton has this vision of America as a nation of merchants and traders and speculators, which is something that Madison and Jefferson don't like at all. And they begin to use plants almost like a botanical weapon against this vision of commerce. So they travel up to the through the New England states, and they question landowners there and farmers, and they note agricultural practices, and they try to find out as much as possible about the culture of sugar maples, because they think that if every farmer in America would have a sugar maple orchard, they would produce enough sugar, so then the Americans would not have to buy molasses from the British West Indies, which would mean they would not have to trade with the old enemy. So plants become incredibly important in a kind of political sense.
You tell the story of how George Washington planted only native shrubs and trees at Mount Vernon, almost as his personal statement of independence, if you will.
Yeah, there's a wonderful scene, which is in the summer of 1776, when America has just declared independence, and Manhattan has been turned into an armed camp in which soldiers drill, and New York is facing 30,000 British troops. This is the largest enemy fleet that has ever arrived on America's shores. And at that moment, when George Washington actually has only half the manpower than the British, and warships kind of come sailing towards New York, which are so imposing, no one has ever seen those before. He, a few days before the Battle of New York, he sits down in his headquarters and he brushes aside his generals and his military maps, and he sits down and he writes a letter to his estate manager in Mount Vernon, and he advises him to design a new garden. And what is even, I suppose, more remarkable than the timing, which I think is quite extraordinary, is that he talks about only to use native species.
The thesis of this book, as I mentioned, is how gardens and gardening by our founding fathers played such an important role in sowing our American national identity. How did you come to this, Andrea? How did you come to write this book?
Really by accident. I wish I could tell you a really great story about this. It's basically it happened when I was researching my last book, which is called The Brother Gardeners, and which is about the British obsession with gardens. And in a way, I would have never thought that that would lead me to write a book about American founding fathers and gardens. But one of the protagonists in that book is a man called John Bartram, who was an 18th century American farmer and plant collector who lived just outside Philadelphia, and who over four decades sent seed boxes to London and completely transformed the English garden by introducing American trees and shrubs. And it was really through him that I noticed this remarkable connection between the founding fathers and nature, because he was a very good friend of Benjamin Franklin. And in fact, it was Benjamin Franklin who had introduced him to the English gardeners. And as I read through Bartram's letters and diaries and accounts, I came across, for example, a visit of the delegates of the Constitutional Convention to Bartram's visit. I found an invoice to George Washington, who had ordered hundreds of trees and shrubs for Mount Vernon. James Madison had visited the garden. John Adams had gone. And even Thomas Jefferson, while he was writing the Declaration of Independence, had found time to visit John Bartram's nursery just outside Philadelphia. So it just kind of popped up again and again. And then I was following Bartram's footsteps through the Appalachian Mountains, because every fall he would go plant collecting there, and I wanted to see the landscapes he had seen. And I stopped at, I basically passed Charlottesville, and I thought, you know, I'll have a look at the home of the writer of the Declaration of Independence. And I went up to Monticello, and that really became almost the inspiration for the book, when everything came together, when I was standing there on the mountaintop seeing this garden, which had really been created by a revolutionary gardener who seemed to have crafted his grounds as carefully as his words. And it was this almost living tapestries of different themes. Like, you know, there was the spectacular landscape, which you could see. There was the 1,000-foot vegetable terrace. So you have this kind of combination of the useful and the beautiful, which seems something very uniquely American. And I just suddenly realized there's something happening here with the founding fathers, which I had never thought about.
Speaking of seeds and seed boxes and founding fathers, tell us about the seed smuggler who penned the Declaration of Independence.
Well, Jefferson actually says that the greatest service that you can render a country is to introduce a new species. And he was the American minister in Paris, and he traveled a lot in Europe, and he noted mainly agricultural practices. I mean, he said, for example, I prefer to talk to farmers and gardeners because they are much more interesting than any other person. And he went to Italy and saw that they had a particular species of rice, which was called upland rice, which he thought would be changing the lives of South Carolina plantation owners because they could move from the swampy kind of malaria infested lowlands into the uplands. So he smuggled the rice out of Italy, but he had to do that under the threat of death penalty, and he thought it was worthwhile. And then later in his life, when he judges the services that he had done to his country, which obviously included the Declaration of Independence, on the same list, he added the introduction of upland rice.
Hmm. I mean, not just carrying these seeds out, stuffing them in his coat, the book says, as much as my coat and pockets would hold, as you say, knowing that he would risk imprisonment. What did you make that these first presidents, these founding fathers, were such avid seed collectors?
Well, I think the what we have to remember is that this is a time when, you know, farming provides the livelihood of most Americans. So crops and seeds are incredibly important, and lots of people are doing this. They just put it on the political agenda, I think. Mm. And I think we tend to see today, we tend to see gardening just as this, you know, ornamental hobby maybe, or if you do a little bit of vegetable garden, but it's very much part of their life.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the revolutionary gardens of our founding fathers. I'm talking with Andrea Wolf, a garden historian and author of Founding Gardeners, The Revolutionary Generation, Nature, and the Shaping of the American Nation. Andrea, your stories and this history gives us such a wonderful portrait of the founding fathers, really as we've not seen before, but I think it's important to remember the legacy of slaves in this story, and their backbreaking work in tilling American soil. Stephen Cohen on our Facebook page writes, let's not forget who really did the work as opposed to who gets the credit. Wasn't the American landscape built on the backs of slaves, and didn't slave labor make it possible for our forefathers' revolutionary landscape designs?
Yes, that's absolutely true. But what we also shouldn't forget, and that is, you know, obviously more hypocritical to, you know, from coming from Jefferson and Washington who and Madison, who had slaves, is that they believed that the foundation of America should really be the small independent farmer with their small self-sufficient farms. They were like this foot soldiers for the young nation. And clearly, their gardens were built on the back of slavery. And I want to give you one example, which I think is very interesting, where Madison does something, I think, quite extraordinary at Montpelier. When he creates his garden for his retirement after after his second term of his presidency, he creates a garden that is an ornamental pleasure ground. So you, as a visitor, you would kind of enter the house, walk through the house, step on the back portico, and you would see the centerpiece of the ornamental pleasure ground, which was a huge level lawn, which was literally embraced by the American forest. And extraordinarily, when you look to the right, 50 yards away from you, you would see a slave village, six neat little buildings kind of nestled around a yard, in the middle of this landscape design. So where other plantation owners had hidden their slave cabins by walls or by putting them in a completely different place on their plantation or by shrubberies or by clumps of trees, he had put six slave cabins in the middle of his garden. And he had others, which were on elsewhere on his plantation, but these ones were built very differently to the usual flimsy slave cabins. They were built as sturdy buildings. They had raised wooden floors. They had brick chimneys. They had glass in the windows. So this was almost like he's creating this model village, which is almost like a tableau of virtuous industry and paternalistic care. And I think he's doing this because, like Washington Jefferson, he has problems to reconcile the ideas of slavery with his beliefs in equality and liberty. And he knows that he will have foreign travelers, people from the North, coming to visit his garden and scrutinizing the slave cabins. And they're going to write about this because that has happened before to Washington and Jefferson. So he's presenting himself as this slave owner who has slaves who are at least happy and cared for. But this is only the bit in the garden. In the rest, on the rest of the plantation, they live in the usual kind of slave cabins with mud floors. Hmm.
You tell a remarkable story in the book of how the constitutional delegation was drawn together by a trip to a local plant nursery, just as they were at the breaking point of disagreement over crafting this foundational document. Tell us that story from the summer of 1787.
Well, it's I would say it's the most speculative of all my examples. Everything else I can really prove. This is a speculation that a visit to Bartram's garden changed the course of history. And well, let me tell you the story. So what happened is in May 1787, the delegates met in Philadelphia to work on the future of America. And the most controversial issue during the convention was really the distribution of power between the larger and the smaller states. Until then, each state had equal votes. And now the larger states, such as Virginia, for example, they were favoring proportional representation because that would give them greater leverage in Congress. And unsurprisingly, the smaller states wanted to keep the one state, one vote rule. And so debates were heated and ideas were brought forward and overturned. And by mid-July, the convention had really come to the verge of collapse. Then someone suggested a visit to Bartram's garden. And on Saturday, the 14th of July, seven delegates went to see the garden at 6 o'clock in the morning. And they spent 3 hours walking amongst America's most glorious trees and shrubs, which the Bartrams had collected from all 13 states. So here they could see the flora from 13 states kind of thriving together in this horticultural union. Now, 2 days later, they met again, and they had to vote on the Connecticut Plan. And the Connecticut Plan was, was a compromise which said that the House of Representatives should be based on proportional representation and the Senate should, each state should have equal votes. The delegates had voted on this before and had dismissed the idea. But this time, the voting took a surprising course because three delegates switched their votes. Caleb Strong from Massachusetts and two delegates from North Carolina. Now, these three delegates had all been to Bartram's garden and they had all voted differently beforehand. So their change of mind happened after the visit of Bartram's Gardens. And we will obviously never know if or how this visit did actually influence these men. But what we do know is that the three men who made the great compromise possible had all been to Bartram's Garden the day before.
Let's get a call in here, Andrea. Michelle is calling from Gallatin, Tennessee. Michelle, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. My three passions in life are plants, politics, and history, so I really appreciate your guest today.
Excellent.
But one of the highlights of my life was visiting Monticello and seeing Jeffersonia in bloom, which is twin leaf. It grows naturally in our hills and hollows in Tennessee, and I just wanted to make that comment. So thankful for what you're doing. Thank you.
Very good, Michelle. Thank you. With that, let's go to Monticello. And joining me now from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Peter Hatch. He's the Director of Gardens and Grounds at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. Welcome to you, Peter. Nice to have you with us.
Good to be here, Jane.
Tell us about the state of Thomas Jefferson's gardens today at Monticello.
Well, it's a beautiful day in Virginia. It's a little overcast, but very warm. And the dark skies make for brilliant colors. Tulips are all in full bloom, and the redbuds and dogwoods are ablaze with color, so it's a lovely time in Virginia right now.
330 varieties of 89 species of vegetables and herbs in the garden there. Is that about right?
That's what Jefferson documented planting over his entire lifetime of gardening at Monticello. Mm.
And about 35,000 visitors every year?
Well, we get almost 500,000 people come a year to Monticello. Mm. We have 35,000 people a year attend our sort of formal garden tours. And in terms of the plants that Jefferson grew, this garden was truly an Ellis Island, if you will, of new and unusual plants that came from around the world. And Monticello was sort of an experimental laboratory for him. And he kept a diary called The Garden Book that documents his lifetime fascination with horticulture, whether it was his puppy love for peas or his statement that the greatest service which can be rendered any country is to add a useful plant to its culture.
Hmm. So what, more broadly speaking, has tending the land of Monticello taught you or shown you about Thomas Jefferson, the man, and the founding father of the United States?
I don't think there's any question. The one thing that strikes you is that trying to find Thomas Jefferson, you dig a hole that you never really find him. He's all things to all people. He's a truly ambiguous figure in the American mind, and even in terms of gardening. Although gardening, I think, was a great expression of both his head and his heart, there was always a gap between what he visualized and dreamed of doing and what actually ended up happening.
You are credited with
all these contradictions with Jefferson that also, I think, in some ways are expressed in his gardens.
Right. Peter, you're credited with bringing back the Revolutionary Gardens to their Jeffersonian stature. And I'm curious what needed to be preserved or changed back to the way it used to be.
Well, the flower gardens at Monticello were put back in the 1930s by the Garden Club of Virginia. And the vegetable and fruit garden was put back, restored in the early 1980s based on Jefferson's, all the things he wrote about gardens, as well as years of archaeological excavations. And then there's another area called the Grove, which is sort of Jefferson's expression of the ideal American garden, an 18-acre forest, where he said that in America we can make gardens without expense. We have only to cut out the superabundant plants. So the restoration of the landscape has been ongoing, and it'll probably continue to go on for the next generation and the next century.
Andrea,
there's
Wolf,
always new things to find about that.
I'm sure that's true. Andrea, what do you see in the gardens of and the great estates of the founding fathers, from Monticello, where Peter Hatch is, to George Washington's Mount Vernon, to James Madison's Montpelier?
I think they're really we can almost read them, I suppose, like their letters, because they use them as a canvas for political statements, and they bring together the themes that really occupied them all their lives. So if you look at Monticello, for example, you have the plants that Lewis and Clark, for example, had brought from their expedition from the West, which are a reminder of the promises that lie in the West. You have the experimental vegetable terrace, which very much is a reflection of Jefferson as an experimental scientific gardener. You have the flower beds, which are in what Peter said earlier, which is really much more his heart, the kind of the beautiful things that he adored. You have within the forest, when you were walking up the mountains, you saw the untamed forest. That was a celebration of America's wilderness. But in between, you had agricultural fields. So he brings together the useful and the beautiful. And I think the same can be said, for example, in Mount Vernon, where you have the all-American ornamental garden around the bowling green, and then the more useful plants within the kind of bullet-shaped walled gardens kind of hidden away. So the first thing that people see is this American native garden. Or another example, I think, in Montpelier, when you have a look at there's a temple in Montpelier. He's actually the only founding father who built an ornamental temple. But it's not just a whimsical ornamental temple as it would have been, say, in an English garden. It has an ice house underneath. So there's, again, this kind of American practical way of doing things. And the same thing Washington does there in Mount Vernon, that he has the outside toilet is in the shrubbery, and it's built like a little temple, which is a very typical English way of designing a shrubbery. You have a little winding walk through the shrubbery, and then you come to a garden statue or a temple. He puts in the toilet there. So again, this kind of very practical approach to gardening, I think.
A wonderful story, Andrea. Let's go to Shay now, who's calling from Boston. Welcome to On Point, Shay.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, go ahead.
I actually was glad you mentioned the Washington. I was curious, I know this is particularly true of Washington, that hemp was a large part of what he grew. I know it wasn't part of the garden necessarily, but part of sort of general agriculture. and for often industrial purposes. And I was wondering sort of what role, I guess, for Washington particularly, or for the Founding Fathers generally, that hemp played, I guess, in the history.
Shay, thank you. Andrea?
Well, I think they all grew it. I think John Adams wrote even an essay about it. So that was, but that was, you know, it was a kind of agricultural crop for them. And they were, I think they didn't have any problems with anything. They were just testing everything. They saw themselves very much as the experimenters. They had to try out for the nation what would work and what wouldn't work because they had larger plantations. So they said they couldn't expect, say, a small farmer to experiment with crop rotation because if the harvest failed, they would not have anything to eat. So they saw themselves as these kind of, you know, model farmers, I suppose.
Experimenters who would pass along little tidbits or nuggets about what they learned to others. I read that about George Washington in the book.
Yeah, they basically they swapped information with each other, but you know they were in contact with a vast number of people, and they would all publish also information in newspapers. So, for example, Washington gets a recipe how to avoid pests on certain plants, and he publishes it in the Virginia Gazette because he thinks, you know, all the local farmers should also know.
I want you to tell the story, Andrea, of the Founding Fathers' interest in, of all things, manure. And this was serious. I mean, it was part of their political agenda, right? An act of nation building, really, to make the soil fertile. Tell the story of John Adams inspecting a pile of dung in London.
Well, I have to say that I think one of the greatest surprises when I was writing this book is to kind of discover that the first four presidents of the United States were all utterly obsessed with manure. So you have Washington, for example, who says, you know, he wants a farm manager who Midas-like converts everything into manure as the first transmutation towards gold. And I think there is hardly a more delightful picture than John Adams as the American minister in London, driving in his carriage up the Edgware Road, and then he sees a pile of manure, and he literally jumps into this pile of manure, not minding the muck on his hands. And he's teasing apart the straw and the dung and declaring with glee that this was not equal to mine. And you have to imagine that at the same time you have the other diplomats, say the Spanish ambassador, for example, they're all rushing through the corridors of the palace in St. James's. And they're all, you know, bejeweled and powdered in silk. And there he is, the American minister to London, standing in a pile of manure, thinking his is better than this.
Your descriptions of John Adams, that one as well, they're just captivating. This proud New Englander who declares himself never happier than when, I think you said, weeding carrots and picking and shelling peas, and perhaps his hands in manure as well.
Thomas Jefferson,
too. Is that right? Yes, Peter, go ahead.
I think you can almost judge the quality of a civilization by the quality of its soil. And Jefferson got a letter when he was serving as Secretary of State from his daughter, and she complained about the insects ravaging her cabbage plants back here at Monticello. And Jefferson wrote to her and said, well, the problem with the plants is that they're growing in poor soil. And he said the two of them that next winter would cover the entire garden with a heavy coating of manure. He said when plants are growing in manure-rich soil, they will then, in turn, in his words, bid defiance to all sorts of pests and diseases and droughts and all the things that afflict us in a summertime in central Virginia. So Jefferson was not only carrying the banner of the organic gardening movement, he didn't have too many alternatives at the time, but he also believed in this sort of balance between wild nature on the one hand and the cultivated garden on the other.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the revolutionary gardens of our founding fathers this hour. We're speaking with Andrea Wolf, garden historian and author of Founding Gardeners. Also with us this hour from Majestic Monticello is Peter Hatch, director of gardens and grounds at Thomas Jefferson's Historical Estate. So many listeners who want to join in, let's go right to John in Boston. Hi, John. Thanks for waiting. Welcome.
Thank you, Jane. What a wonderful program. But basically, the reason why I called is because Filippo Mattei happened to be a friend of Jefferson. He brought over from Italy a bunch of different types of grapes from Florence, and he brought them to Virginia, and they tried to plant a vineyard, so they could have a vineyard. And mm-hmm. at any rate, the weather wasn't conducive for that sort of types of agriculture, you know, mm-hmm. having grapes. And so they decided to have an apple orchard instead, and that's how they started making apple juice and that sort of thing.
Oh, good story, John. Thank you. Peter Hatch, do you know about that?
Yeah, Philip Mazzei is really an intriguing figure. He's the only Italian-American patriot I know, and he arrived at Monticello on his way to the Shenandoah Valley in the early 1770s with bold dreams of creating a viticultural and an agrarian paradise in the Shenandoah Valley. And Jefferson waylaid them and persuaded Mazzei to settle on land adjacent to Monticello, and it began a long-term horticultural relationship. Mazzei's vignerons planted the first vineyards at Monticello. Mazzei tried to grow grapes at his vineyard next door. And the whole story of Jefferson and viticulture and grape growing is fascinating. He said amazing things about grapes, such as no nation is drunken when wine is cheap, or wine is indispensable to my health. And I think he always perhaps aspired to make a Monticello-grown wine. But the fact that he planted his vineyard some six different times suggests a perennial trouble with growing grapes on top of this mountain.
John, I'm glad you called. Yes, go ahead.
His legacy in grape growing is really profound and is recalled a lot today by the resurgent Virginia wine industry.
Here's another call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Andrea is on the line. Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
I love your program. I love gardens. I'm a gardener, and I want to make 2 points.
Okay.
One is that the manure anecdote is certainly the same as today the compost argument. People do compare compost piles and what's in them the same way that John Adams compared the manure. The second thing is that there's another side to the story about appreciation of natural beauty, and that is what land developers did. For example, around New Orleans, there was widespread complete destruction of the bald cypress forests, very beautiful, which used to protect New Orleans from the sea. So there's another side to the story. I just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
All right, Andrea, thank you. Well, it brings up actually an interesting point that I wanted to ask you about, Andrea, and that is the environmentalism that sort of surrounded some of the founding fathers and when what they did. You write about a speech that James Madison gave in which he discusses the fragility of the ecosystem, and he emphasizes the need for protecting the environment, which was certainly unique in the time. You know, James Madison, the father of environmentalism, not really a well-known story, but tell us about his preoccupation with the environment.
Yeah, I think for me this was a really extraordinary story because James Madison is always, you know, he's like kind of presented as a little bit kind of more boring, I suppose, than the others, because he, you know, although he's the father of the Constitution, he's this kind of brilliant legal mind, but people don't get really excited about him in terms of his character. And I think he's a really, really fascinating man. And what he also is, he's the forgotten father of American environmentalism. He said in 1818 in a very widely circulated speech that the protection of the environment was essential for the survival of America. And he's not suggesting to live in, you know, misty-eyed harmony with nature. And what he said is that nature was a fragile ecological system that could be very easily destroyed. And he said something which I think is really very radical, because he said that man had to return to nature what man took from nature. And these were radical, radical ecological views, because what he's doing at a time when most people still believe that God created man, God created animals and plants entirely for the use of man, he's actually saying nature cannot be made subservient to mankind. And he is, the interest for this comes really from the decline of Virginia at that time, because Virginia, Virginians had destructed a lot of the forest. The soil was completely depleted from tobacco cultivation, and more of these small farmers, which the founding fathers saw as the foot soldiers of this nation, were actually fleeing towards the West. So they were, that was one of the reasons why they were so obsessed with manure, because they wanted to kind of replenish the soil.
Right.
And But I think this, the Madison basically talks about the balance of nature, and he says that man has to find a place in nature without destroying it, which, you know, are words which remain as important today as they were when he spoke them.
Indeed. Beth is on the line from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Beth. Welcome.
Hi there, Jane. Hi. Thank you. I'm interested in knowing if it's possible, or if there are for sale any seeds like at Monticello that Thomas Jefferson grew, if there are any possibilities of getting perhaps seeds from plants that he grew, you know, many, many generations later.
Peter, can Beth transplant some seeds from Jefferson to her flower garden?
Yeah, we have a seed program that can be accessed through our website, and we have lots, probably 70 different kinds of 18th and 19th century varieties of flowers and vegetables, and many of them are Jefferson varieties that we sell through our museum stores. And that's, if you Google Monticello or go to our website, it's readily accessible there. But it's a program we have to share sort of these tangible links to the past. And we have some of the Jefferson's favorite vegetables, for example, his tennis ball lettuce or prickly seeded spinach. So it's a nice program of being able to share and also preserve a lot of these vegetable and flower forms.
Wonderful, Peter. Beth, good luck.
There's also, just for Beth also, there's also in John Bartram's garden in Philadelphia, they do plant sales, and they also sell the old native species that the founding fathers have ordered from Bartram's nursery.
Andrea, tell the story of George Washington running his gardens and fields with such military precision, and how he was leading the Revolutionary Army on Valley Forge, and in his mind, what is he thinking about seeds and seedlings? Tell the story.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that story from the beginning about the battle in New York, that kind of continues really throughout the Revolutionary War, that Washington would write regular letters to his estate manager, Mount Vernon. He's trying to, you know, still run the farm from the battlefield, basically. And in the letters, he would also describe what happened during battles or during the winter of Valley Forge. But at the same time, he'd also ask after plants. He would advise him what to plant, what to not to plant. And he would, so there were these amazing letters where, on the one hand, he's describing the terrible, terrible difficulties they are going through in this winter, but at the same time, he's describing the kind of beautiful kind of icicles he sees on the tree. So there is this real appreciation for nature which continues throughout the Revolutionary War, and where, for example, when he has his army marching through Philadelphia, every single man has to put a little sprig of green on their head as a kind of symbol of hope.
John is on the line from Mystic, Connecticut. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. With regard to John Adams and the manure pile of London proclaiming that his was better, I have to think that that must have something to do with the fact that they were combating the notion of American inferiority, which I understand is a philosophy that was held in Europe that said that the people and the produce and everything on the continent was inferior in some way to the European variety of it.
John, thank you. Yes. Andrea, true?
Yes, there's a whole, I mean, Jefferson gets very much involved in this discussion, actually, because the French are actually talking about the degeneracy of America. There are some French scientists who basically say that if plants and animals and humankind gets transplanted to America, they will decline. So the size suddenly matters. So the bigger, the better. So Jefferson begins to use this in his battle against Europe. So he gets friends, while he's in Paris, he gets friends to send him a pelt of panthers, a moose, which he's going to set up to prove that the moose is much bigger than the reindeer. He gets Madison to measure even the nails of a weasel to kind of prove that the nails of a weasel in America are larger than the ones in Europe. So they use nature as a weapon, really, to show the old world that America is better.
Let's get another call in here. Paul is in Boston. Hi, Paul. Welcome.
Hi. I want to pick up on the manure analogy with the statistic. I think it's important to note also that 7 of our first 9 presidents were slave owners, and it feels to me like the issue of enslavement was glossed over when it was talked about, and it often is, and I think it's essential that we name that. Monticello would not have existed without the slaves that Jefferson owned, not only because they built Monticello, but also because they gave Jefferson and other founding fathers the wealth to build something like Monticello and have the leisure time to do their writing and do their gardening and be the gentleman farmers that they were. And I think it's important that, and in fact, we couldn't have fought the resolution without that wealth. And if we take that wealth further down the road, our whole economic system, both in the South and the North, is based on that system. And I think we need to continue to explicitly name that, because it's not done so often in the public discourse around our history and around race and racism.
Paul, I'm glad you did. Thank you very much for calling. Andrea?
I'd be happy to talk on that issue just briefly.
Okay, Peter, go ahead.
We know a lot about the who gardened at Monticello, because we have this wealth of information about slaves at Monticello. And in fact, Jefferson's giant terrace vegetable garden was carved out of the earth and hewed over a period of 3 years by five slaves that Jefferson contracted with a farmer in Fredericksburg, Virginia. And the relationship between Jefferson and his slave gardeners is interesting. It was sort of a reciprocal thing. Jefferson would often sow the seeds of plants themselves, while Wormley Hughes, who sometimes called Monticello's head gardener, he was an enslaved African American, probably did a lot of the digging work and the harvesting of certain vegetables. But a freed slave, years after Jefferson died, his name is Isaac Jefferson. He was a blacksmith in Petersburg, recalled how Jefferson himself would work for about a half an hour at a right hard pace in the cool evening. So Jefferson actually did do some gardening, but it was certainly the slaves who created much of Monticello.
John, thank you for calling. Andre, I'd like to ask you, in the day of our founding fathers, fewer than 1 in 20 Americans lived in towns. The majority of America was rural. In a time when it is exactly the opposite, the city dwelling is now the predominant lifestyle in America, where do you see the relationship between gardening and politics? Is it still alive?
Well, I hope it would be a little bit more alive, but I think, you know, that you can see today kind of slowly changing attitudes towards local produce and home growing. There are inner city gardens, there are, urban farms in Brooklyn. So there are farms and vegetable beds on houses on top of the roof. So something, you know, is changing there. I think it still has to do very much to do with politics, because agriculture is still an incredibly important kind of economic part of a country. I think it's something we can't forget at all. And I think that we really have to think about what we are eating and how we are subsidizing agriculture and things like that. And, you know, I very often get the question, like, what would the founding fathers kind of think about it today? How would they do it? And it's a very difficult question to answer, because especially Jefferson, for example, who once said that every generation should even make their own laws and constitution, and he was a very innovative person, so who knows where he would be today. But I think, you know, I mean, Peter can probably talk a little bit more about the kitchen garden at the White House, which I think is an incredibly important first step to show people how important food and locally grown food is.
Thank you. Peter, tell us about that. You tended another president's garden beyond Thomas Jefferson's, the Obama White House garden, when the First Lady asked you to start a vegetable garden on the grounds in 2009.
I think, you know, Jefferson's legacy in food and gardening and wine is really profound. Even when he was president, he kept a chart of 37 different vegetables and when they first and last appeared in the farmer's market of Washington, D.C., and according to some stories, it was he who got seeds from foreign consuls who would vie with each other. Then he would then get these seeds and pass them out to local farmers. And I think the legacy is profound. And the chefs at the White House have always been interested in the garden here at Monticello. And I think it was an influence in the creation of that of the White House kitchen garden, which Michelle Obama said perhaps one of the most important things she's ever done in her life so far.
And so what was that experience like for you to plant the Jefferson seeds at the White House? Artichokes and kale and beets and all the rest?
Right. We brought a lot of there's a special Jefferson section. And to go to the White House during all the tumultuous times in the world and with school children to plant Jefferson varieties of lettuce and spinach and kale is was really a meaningful thing, just personally for me. Again, I think that the gardening and soils are so very, very important to reinvigorating this country, and I think the Jefferson legacy is a great thing to promote and to serve as a foundation for some of the things we're doing today.
Andrea Wolf, in our last 30 seconds here, what would be the thought that you would leave with us about our founding fathers and their passion for gardening?
I think the thing I would like to say is really to kind of read Madison's speech he wrote in 1818 and kind of everything what you should do about the environment, really.
Well, Andrea Wolf is the author of Founding Gardeners, The Revolutionary Generation, Nature, and the Shaping of the American Nation. For an excerpt of the book, go to our website at onpointradio.org. What a delight to have you. I just so enjoyed the book. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Peter Hatch is the director of gardens and grounds at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, where he restored the grounds to their state during Jefferson's residence. It's nice to have you with us, sir. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, at our website, On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.